you know, Stannis fanboying, I think, has to, you know, it's kind of like cat ownership. You have to accept a certain amount of yowling and clawing of things that you wouldn't like clawed. And, you know, why did you take a shit in the bathtub, Stannis? Good question.
You have a really bad cat. It's not even
anything. I don't have a really bad cat. I have a cat.
And welcome to episode 68 of the great linear reread of A Song of Ice and Fire by George R. R. Martin. We are the Vassals of Kingsgrave, an offshoot of a podcast of Ice and Fire.
As usual, it could potentially spoil any events in George R. R. Martin's published series, but we will be careful with TOR spoilers, preview chapter spoilers, and if we want to discuss it at some point, I'll put spoiler warnings. It will not, however, contain show spoilers. Let me also say that the views expressed here on this podcast are those of the individual hosts and not of VOK as a whole, because we all have our own personalities and opinions, which is good. So the last episode ended with Sansa 1 from A Feast for Crows on the 16th of February 300. In this episode, we will cover Brienne 3, Arya 1, aka the Queenmaker from A Feast for Crows, and Jon 1 from A Dance with Dragons. All three chapters take place on the 17th of February 300. God, I hate numbers. Okay, now to the introductions. I'm Mary, or Nymeria on the forums. I'm joined today by Sarah.
Hi, I'm Sarah, also known as Lady Weaver on the forums.
I'm Michael.
Hey, this is Carl Wadegi on the forums.
Dan.
Hi, this is Witless Chum on the forums.
Okay, Noah.
Hi, Noah Pops 88 on the forums.
Awesome. And probably we will have Jock and Tanya a bit later. So Dan, yeah, you've been involved with the community, I think, for much longer than I have, but it's your first time on a reread. So let's do this for our listeners of the reread. Tradition is tradition. Can you tell us how you got into the books? Who are your favorite or less favorite characters? And maybe what you've thought of the reread so far, if you've been reading along.
Well, what I think of the reread, first of all, is that it's not a proper reread. No, nobody remembers that reference. I'm like one of the first ones FT Ward was like, well,
I remember.
Because it's not canon by George.
Yeah, because the order is wrong, so it's not actually a reread. It's okay.
God, I rolled my eyes at that.
But we're reading all of the chapters.
Yeah. Well, and I don't think I'll ever read Feast and Dance, not in the mixed together Sean T. Collins order again. So I don't actually believe that. I just like FT Ward's curmudgeonliness about it.
Yeah, he was very passionate, which I understand and respect.
So I first got into the books actually before the show, so I'm a weirdo in that way. Just a guy I work with was like, you know, had suggested I read Memory, Sorrow, and Thorn by Tad Williams, and then he was like, hey, you like that, you know, you should like this. I hadn't read too much fantasy previous to that, just pretty much The Lord of the Rings. And some of the Lloyd Alexander Priordane books when I was a kid. So I read, and at that point, you know, read at that point the four books and was like, wow, this is awesome. You know, I want to hear more people's opinions about that. So I found a podcast of Ice and Fire pretty quickly.
Great. I've actually read this Tad Williams series. I mean, I think that's the same. That was a fun read. Cool. You're not a weirdo. I've started with the books too. I mean, yeah. there was no way I was going to watch the show before I read the books. Okay.
Well, there was no show at this point, actually.
Yeah, for you. Yeah, for me, it was just starting. And that's what actually got me into the books, but before I watched the show. And about the characters?
I tend to not have too strong of favorites, but I would say Brienne. Brienne is probably the one that I'm most, like, emotionally attached to. And,
yay.
You know, I worry about that. But, you know, I certainly love Stannis also, just because, I mean, frankly, because he's so funny.
Well, it's a good episode for you then. Okay.
Good to have both Stannis and Brienne defender. Not that I hate either character, but always good. Sometimes we're in short supply.
Yeah, definitely. Okay, let's get going. So after Sansa 1, which was the last episode, the last chapter on the last episode, we jump forward 50 pages, that's three chapters, to Brienne 3. She's 20 years old at this point, and I believe we have Sarah for the recap.
Hi, Jock's here now too. Sorry if you haven't noticed.
Oh yeah, sorry, yeah, I've noticed and then I forgot to introduce you. I'm sorry, Jock. Okay, thanks, Sarah. So we have Jock with us now. Hi, Jock.
Oh, he just...
Oh, he left.
That's perfect timing.
Somebody do a real insulting Scottish accent. Be Jock.
Okay, he's back. Jock, hi.
Hi.
Glad to have you with us. Okay, you can go, Sarah.
Okay. Brienne and Pod are on the road between Duskendale and Maidenpool. We learn about Pod's past and how since his father's death, he was passed off to his cousin, Sir Cedric Payne, by his mother, and was treated like a servant and taught how to groom a horse. Since Sir Cedric died in Tywin's Host in the Riverlands, he's attached himself to Sir Lorimer the Belly and was taught to steal up until Lorimer was hanged for stealing salted ham from Tywin's personal stores. Kevin Lannister took charge of him and gave him to Tyrion as a squire, and Tyrion sent him to Arryn Santagar up until his death in the Red Riots to be taught swordsmanship. Brienne and Pod come across a farmer and his wife taking eggs to Maidenpool for Dickon Tarly's wedding, which reminds Brienne of her first betrothal. She and Pod are told the Hound has crossed the Trident with 100 men and is raping every wench they come across and cutting off their teats for trophies. Maidenpool's gatekeepers try to take the farmer's eggs for a fraction of their worth and want to rape the farmer's wife. Brienne tries to stop it but is unable to with words, and Hyal Hunt steps in and calls off the soldiers. Hyal follows her into town and forces her to see Randall Tarly, who has put his men to work rebuilding Maidenpool. Tarly is hearing the complaints of the people and dispensing justice. Upon Tarly's demands, Brienne tells him that they are under King Tommen's orders to find Sansa Stark. Randall said Sansa is not in Maidenpool and probably went to the north, but Brienne expresses her opinion that she may be in the Vale, and Randall tells her of Lysa's death. Hyal tries to apologize to Brienne for the bet he waged on her maidenhead and tells Brienne that three of the knights of summer died on the Blackwater and another lost half an arm. Brienne sends him away and gets Pod to find the pair lodging for the night, while Brienne goes to the Stinking Goose to find Dick Crabb. Brienne pays Dick Crabb a glass of wine, two silver stags, and one gold stag for information about the fool. Dick Crabb says the fool was looking for passage for three, himself and two girls. Dick never met the two girls. Nibble Dick Crabb sent them to the Whispers, a smuggler's cove that has not been used for the last 30 years. He promises to take her there for six gold dragons if she finds her sister, two for the fool, and for no gold at all if no one is there.
Okay, well, maybe you have some talking points, Sarah, that you want to bring up since you recapped this.
Do we want to start talking, like, linearly, work our way through the chapter then?
Yeah, sure.
Okay. Makes sense.
It does. So how about we talk about Pod, because we all love him, right?
Yeah.
Poor Podra.
Oh my god, I know. Like, the poor kid, since he's been four, he's been passed around from pillar to post to different people to take care of him, and no one's actually treated him like a kid or been a parental figure for him.
Yeah, it seems like the closest is probably Tyrion, and, you know, we saw how that went. You know, Andy fought in this horrific battle.
Yeah.
He reminds me of a number of the prologue characters we meet who then horribly die in that chapter, but, like, people who sort of have been neglected or forgotten about in this society, and there's no like, social security net to save these people. Yeah, know, so he'd make a good prologue character.
Don't say that. Like, the only thing that stops Pod from being killed when Sir Lorimer was killed is his name, the fact he was a pain. Otherwise, he was going to be put to death as well. Yeah.
Pretty brutal.
It's really brutal. And the thing is, it's not necessarily Podrick's fault for that, or Podrick's fault that he's been taught to steal. It's the circumstances he's had to grow up in. And I also want to say, Brienne, get rid of Pod, because, like, he's bad news. He's super bad luck. Because all of his masters have died, or, like, in Tyrion's case, is often in another country hiding and, like, managed
but, you
to
know, we've,
get out of it.
Yeah, we've talked about the fact that the Brienne chapters are in some way there to show us how terrible the war was and still is, and what are the this shape of the country now, and the harsh reality of the world, and Pod also plays a role in that, because he's been abandoned again and again, and, like, I like the pair, the two of them together really make a good team.
Yeah, the Sir M'lady thing is makes me smile every time.
Yeah.
And he, you know, sometimes he does it in the other order, but he never can decide to pick one.
Maybe it's because he's like, I know you're a woman, but you're also a knight, at least in my eyes. So I'll say both.
Mm-hmm.
Which is sweet, but
yeah,
he needs to pick one too. And how about we talk about Pod being a swordsman and how Brienne cuts off some sticks and then uses them as practice swords with Pod to see how good or bad he is with it. And that he might be slow of speech, but not of hand. And that she thinks that he's fearless and attentive, but he was also underfed and skinny and nowhere near strong enough. So I think that if she feeds him up and teaches him properly, he might actually turn out to be quite a good swordsman. And because it seems like he already has natural talent or has caught on very quickly with it, because Aaron Santagar was only able to teach him for a very short amount of time, and none of his previous masters before that taught him any swordsmanship.
Yeah, even Tyrion thinks that, you know, I'm amazed that this kid who can barely speak, he keeps such a level head during the battle. So yeah, he's got potential.
Yeah, I think he really does. And, no, I was just going to say he's 13 or 14, so yes, he's a lot older than when people normally start training.
Yeah.
But, yeah.
But he's still quite young. I mean, he's not
a 40-year-old.
Yeah. We actually have, so we have the shadow of Bina with us today, because she wrote a number of notes about these chapters. So she has one about this. It's that she thinks it's interesting that no one has replaced Aaron Santagar as Master at Arms at King's Landing, and she thinks it shows how the local government has been brought to a halt in King's Landing, which is very true. I mean, it seems completely absurd that no one has been appointed to replace him.
So about 8 months have passed since the Brad riots where he's killed. So yeah, it does seem really, really crazy that for 8 whole months there's been no Master at Arms at the Red Keep.
Yeah, I mean, if Definitely. It was just Cersei, well, that's Cersei, but Kevin was there too, and Tyrion before that, so it's still weird.
Definitely, and as well, in theory, because there's no Master at Arms, no one's being trained in swordsmanship, and you have wars going on, and all of your practiced knights and everything like that should be off fighting them, so...
Yeah,
it's very silly because it means that a lot of your skilled people are going off and possibly dying or coming back injured. So you're leaving yourself at a disadvantage by not training up the next generation.
We do see some of the Tyrell soldiers and Lannister soldiers. They're still training in the yard, but I don't know what the official job of the Master at Arms is. Maybe they give out the armor or... make a schedule. I don't know. Does anyone know what the Master at Arms does?
Well, at least for the royal children.
People.
Like he should be the Master at Arms should be teaching Tommen or young squires like Pod, who is actually the squire of Tyrion, so he's not no one. So I guess that's mainly his job to be teaching squires and royal princes.
Yeah,
it's one of these things where it probably depends on who has the job to how, you know, to see how, you know, wide their influence and responsibility is too. Like, you know, when we hear from the Duncan Egg stories about Fireball being the Master of Arms, and you know, he made it into a really influential position eventually. Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
It doesn't seem like Aaron Santigar did much except for, you know, train noble children in the yard. You know, you don't hear about him really in many other contexts.
Yeah.
Well, you see, we see Roderick Cassell. We get a little bit more of a glimpse up into his importance in the Stark family.
Mm-hmm. So that's true.
It seems like a position in quite high esteem. Yeah, one you'd want to sort out and fill quite quickly.
Yeah.
Agreed.
So, I think it speaks to the clusterfuck that was after the Battle of the Blackwater. Like, just so many things had to be done in preparation to the wedding and stuff. I mean, it's still crazy, but yeah, a lot
but
of shit was going
is,
on.
Yeah, a wedding isn't necessarily a matter of life and death, whereas making sure you have people training is, because having people married doesn't really have an effect on whether or not they'll live. So I just think it's really bad. Like,
I think Mace Tyrell might have disagreed with you on that one.
Into things. Well, you could have been like, hey, Mace, okay, make sure you have someone out there training our kids, and then we'll get the marriage sorted. But, like, sort them both out. Don't just put all of your attention on one thing and completely forget the other stuff. That's silly.
Well, to be fair, Tywin was pretty busy with the Red Wedding.
So Tywin gets the top, but no one
else. Also, and it also in link with Podrick, Bina notes that it's kind of sad that Brienne is melancholic about an alternative life where she's a mother. And she reflects on the fact that she's one of the few characters in A Song of Ice and Fire who would probably be actually a good mother. So what do you agree with that?
I
think she'd be a good Master at Arms.
Yes. No, I think that she'd be such a different character, and if she was a mother, and because she's constantly teased because of her appearance, I don't think marrying someone when you're young, because it would have been about 13, like within a year of her first period was when she would have been married. I don't think being married would have had any effect on how other people treat her. And she still would have been mocked for her appearance. That's what I think. So
I guess it would depend who to.
Who she was married to, yeah. But
quite possibly.
Still, I agree with Sarah, but she could still, she I mean, I don't think that's a good, that would have been a good life for her. And she also thinks that herself, like, she's both a bit sad that it didn't happen and also relieved. But she, I do think that she would have been a good mother. She's a kind person and she had a good father.
Yes. And there's nothing to say that she can't go on to be a mother, providing she
lives. Oh, for sure. For sure.
And there's nothing to say she won't be a fantastic mother going forward. And to Jock's point, it, depending on who her husband is or potentially could have been, she may have still been able to go and practice swordsmanship, depending on who she married. Unlikely, but
yeah.
But maybe.
Still, yeah, if what's his name didn't want a third bone broken, he'd let her go practice.
Yep.
No, I mean, I can imagine Brienne being a very good mother just because, you know, she is kind and sweet and, you know, just sort of a nice person in general. But I mean, it's the sort of thing where, you know, yeah, there's not really a role in Westeros for a woman who's both a badass warrior and a mother. So it would be super hard for her to do that.
Brienne definitely has this very negative view of herself as a traditionally feminine woman. Like she, I get the sense she kind of thinks that she fails at this in all regards. And that's kind of one of the reasons why she turns to being a knight, sort of to make up for this failure. But I do agree she'd be very empathetic as a mother, you know, to children that don't get things the way they want. But yeah, she reminds me a bit of Sam in this regard, in that Sam also thinks he doesn't measure up as a man in any capacity.
Yeah, he's... Or they are both very self-defeating and don't... And I think they underestimate themselves, or at least Sam does, and I think Brienne might as well in some aspects. But I think Brienne's opinion of herself has also been reinforced by everyone around her whole life.
Well, that's the same for and Sam. I mean,
definitely.
That's why they are so similar. It's because the opinion of people around them can always belittling them or calling her a freak. Of course, that's what shaped them to be who they are now.
Interestingly enough, both of these people are going to have significant interactions with Randall Tarly.
Yep. Good transition.
I was going to say, Randall probably should have... That would have been a good match for Sam, surely. Him and Brienne.
Yeah.
Actually, yeah.
I've never thought of that pairing Sam before. That's great.
Surely.
It would, okay. But I also don't think Randall would stand for it.
Like, you know what? I'm not so sure it would work. Like, I think Brienne needs... Okay, that's my Jamie and Brienne fantasy talking, but...
Jamie and Brienne fantasy. No, but I don't think Brienne would be attracted to the type of person Sam is, because in her head, we see that she's attracted to very... outgoing and witty people, so Renly, Jamie, and at least initially Hyle Hunt.
Yeah.
And people that also like respect her as a warrior too.
Well, people who could, I mean, she wants respect for her skill with the sword and I'm not saying that Sam wouldn't respect her because he would obviously, but she wants that respect from a peer, from someone, from other knights. So I think she wouldn't be very interested in Sam romantically, but who knows?
Yep. We've never...
And she also just wants someone who's charismatic and outgoing and all the things that she's never had the opportunity to be, and she never thinks that she will be able to be.
Yeah.
Well, maybe by the time, you know, they meet, Sam will be, you know, badass, savage Sam Tarly.
He'll have
hearts banging over his shoulder and, you know, be wearing an eye patch or something. And You never know. Characters change.
Yeah, very true.
Yeah. Yeah, he'll have a six pack as well.
But Sam totally loves Gilly, though. Only problem with this fan shipping.
Yeah. Okay, should we maybe talk about Lord Tarly, actually, Randall Tarly, and this interaction? I think it's interesting to see him. That's one of the things we get with the Brienne chapters. We do see a lot of people, even though we kind of run in circles.
He's a sadistic bastard, though. He just loves cutting things off people.
That's awful, right? I mean,
yeah.
He's a sadistic bastard and a sexist bastard. But he,
yeah,
I
have
well, that goes without saying. He is awful to Brienne.
And yeah, basically like, any other woman in the story.
I almost really get the impression that he's not even sadistic. He just doesn't care, or he just doesn't view these small folk as sort of being worthy of care and consideration.
Well,
with his punishments, I think he's very similar to Stannis, where it's just like, you did the crime, this is your punishment. Apart from the one with the woman, I'm like, I don't think that's fair. Washing her out with lye and then having her sending her to the black cells, where it's still, she's a prostitute, but your men are the ones who went to her. That's their problem.
Like, and it could have as easily have been one of his soldiers who's disease ridden. Do you know what I mean?
That's possibly where she got it from as well.
Well, exactly, the first one, and then everyone has it now.
Yeah, that's the one. Well, also, like, this is extra. You know, this dude is enjoying you know, giving out these punishments because, you know, and also I think Tarly seems to sort of, the detail and kind of care he takes in the horrible punishments he's, you know, dealing out here, I think that kind of shows that he's sort of, you know, I think he's getting off on it at some, you know, in some manner, just because he's taking so much care with, you know, like, seven fingers, but not the thumbs.
Yeah,
I mean, when you think about that, you know, that guy's probably going to die because he's going to have three fingers left. He can't do any work. He, you know, what can he do? He's so screwed.
Well, leaving the thumbs as if that's some kind of kindness.
Well, it is maybe for Randall Tarly, but
yeah.
And then when he puts the nail through the archer's hand, it's like, okay, he can't be an archer now. So like, these three people have all had their livelihoods ruined, and they're probably all gonna die. Like, it's so extreme.
Yeah, he just sees it as setting an example to the rest of the small folk or his soldiers.
Yeah.
I mean, I guess that's why those soldiers... Why, maybe. But that's why those soldiers at the gate left Brienne alone once they mentioned his name, because they know he's going to follow through and probably kill a couple of them.
Yeah, but it wasn't when Brienne said his name. It was once Heil Hunt came out and was just like, you know, seriously, she's not making it up.
Yeah, well, I guess that just follows the pattern of sexism in this chapter.
It does. And, oh, by the way, Heil Hunt coming out of the gatehouse and being like, bitches, well, not really bitches, but actually, seriously, back off, dudes. That was, like, such an awesome introduction, and how George introduced him as a character was fabulous.
You do get a good impression of him. He's kind of a jerk. I get some vague nice guy tendencies from him when he's trying to apologize to Brienne. Brienne's like, you've done this awful thing to me. An apology is not, you know, it's not enough. And he's like, oh, but some of us died. And he's like, God, yeah. I don't
I'm not a fan,
but I really don't like him.
He really reminds me of Jaime, actually. At least Jaime when earlier on in the series is what it reminds me of, like, massively.
He's a very, very poor man's Jaime Lannister.
I know, but Brienne doesn't have Jaime there right now. Make the best of it.
His character is, I mean, it helps bringing something more to Brienne's story, and we learn about her past and some of the things that happened to her and that scarred her. I mean, this story, the whole everything that happened at Bitterbridge, all these summer nights, which also was a nice reference to Catelyn. It helps us understand her a lot more and liking her too. So that's why I'm kind of I have mixed feelings about these Brienne chapters, because the character is really well written and really interesting, and her interactions with Hyle here, with Podrick, with Tully, it's really interesting. It's just the goal to find Sansa. We know from the very beginning that it's not going to work. So it's just frustrating to see her talk with this dick crab person and going whoever knows where.
On a wild goose chase.
Yeah, quite.
That started at the stinking goose.
Well, it started at the stinking goose.
Oh, George. I get it now, George. Well done.
Sorry, I snuck in before you there.
It's all good.
But, you know, I agree. There's good chapters underneath here, but they just get bogged down and they needed to be a bit tighter. In my ideal re-edit of A Feast for Crows, this would have been Brienne's second chapter, not her third, because that first one really didn't do anything. Like, just get it out of here.
This chapter goes on for so long. This chapter is, I think, about double the other two chapters in this episode, at least. I think it was like 30 pages, where most of his chapters are like 10 to 15 pages.
Yeah, I remember reading this and I was enjoying it right up till we got to Randall. That was cool interaction. And then when she goes to the Stinking Goose and describing all the barmaid and the people that go there, and then the discussion with Dick Crab, I was like, this needs to be tied up. This is where George is getting a bit lazy.
Yeah, I really enjoy the first half of this chapter up until the end of the Randall stuff and she leaves Hyle Hunt. And then I like the bit where she's talking about the bet they had, but I don't particularly enjoy the Nimble Dick Crab stuff. I'm like, cut it out. But
I mean,
that's the point of the chapter, really.
Well, how can you really be invested in her quest when you know she's not going to succeed? Like, it's just hard to be invested in a character's journey when it's frustrating all along, because you know she's going into a trap, you know she's not going to find Sansa or Dantos or anyone. And I mean, we're going to have the Arianne chapter afterwards too, which is also, in my mind, it's also difficult to invest in this story because we don't really know the characters, and we also we don't know from the beginning that it won't work, but we haven't known for the plot long enough to care about it. Well, with Brienne, we just know it's not going to work. So it's just mostly frustrating despite the good world building and character building that we have.
You know, all of these chapters are redundant. None of them actually do anything.
I feel this is important for later books, if we ever get them, in establishing Randall Tarly in person, because I very strongly believe that Sam, who's now down in Old Town, which is right next to Horn Hill, is going to have some dramatic confrontation with his father. So it's important that, in addition to having Sam recall Randall Tarly, we also meet Randall Tarly in the flesh and see how he interacts with other people.
Yeah.
And now I'm going to tell you guys why you're all completely wrong. And Brienne's journey in A Feast for Crows is my favorite part, probably my favorite single part and arc of the books. And it's just great, and you're all bad.
No, the thing is, I'd love it if it was just her story arc and they cut out the extra stuff. And like, if it was its own story, we'd probably really enjoy it. But I think, like Nymeria, or like Marie says, we already know where Sansa is, which is the part that's so frustrating thing as a reader, but I really enjoyed the Brienne chapters. Like, man, hit me up, which is why this is, I prefer Feast so much more than Dance, because all the characters I don't like are in Dance and all of the ones I do like are in Feast.
Yeah, I love her chapters on a reread. Like once I know that nothing's going to happen, I can take my time and the interesting bits about Brienne's character are there, and that's good. But yeah, a chapter needs to be both interesting on the first reread and then the second, or the first read and what comes after.
No, I mean I'm going to tell you guys you're all completely wrong. The extra stuff is a lot of what I really love about Brienne's journey and sort of. You know, that George is, you know, he's widening the picture of Westeros that we get. And, you know, you've got all these little, you know, you've got all these like tiny little dramas that Brienne kind of goes along through. You know, it's like a road movie, or, you know, it's like Huck Finn, where they're going down the Mississippi and they see, you know, they see this happen and this happen and this happen. And like, I mean, this little thing, like, you know, this starts with this little vignette with the farmer and his wife just trying to get into the gate at, you know, a town that's, you know, in pretty good shape for some of the places in the Riverland. And, you know, they basically, you know, have to almost, you know, she has to almost be raped and they have to have their produce stolen almost. And, you know, it's, there's like all these tiny little dramas that Brienne wanders through. And that's just what I really love about her arc and how you, you know, see all this. You know, I feel like I'm sort of seeing behind the scenes of the story that I just read in the first three books, you know? And as far as the fact that, you know, we know that it's not going anywhere, because, you know, yeah, you're right. We knew that it's not going anywhere. I 100% am not making this up. I remember reading it, you know, sort of at the time where, you know, she didn't, by the end of her arc, she hadn't gotten to Sansa. And I thought, like, you know, wow, that's like how every fantasy book should happen. Because in every, you know, in so many fantasy books, you have these, you know, equally doomed searches that go ahead, but they work. You know, like they find the hobbits, you know, when they're chasing, when they're chasing them across the plains there in the Two Towers. And
yeah,
that should never work. And I think it's really neat how in Feast, and, you know, both Feast and Dance, George gives us an example of like a doomed, insane quest that could be like the centerpiece of a different fantasy story. But then in his version, it doesn't work. And it actually turns out kind of like, you know, it sort of should in his version of, you know, the fantasy world where things don't work out exactly the way, you know, the way for everybody. So that's what I'm. That's sort of why, you know, what you're saying is, which is certainly true. Yeah, you know, the whole time, you know, even reading it the first time, I think you don't expect her to find Sansa really very much. Or at least maybe I didn't.
Yeah.
But, you know, that's why I think that's, you know, that's why you're all completely wrong.
And that's a good point, actually. Yeah. And it's great. Like, that's why it's so great to have you on this, because we need to have people defending this kind of story arcs, because they're really not very much loved in the fandom, I think, but mostly because we're kind of tired probably of waiting. I think that plays a big role into what we think on the rereads.
Yeah, and
I wonder you go, Sarah.
Okay, with Dan's point about how all of the extra stuff and how the little vignettes with the small folk stories, that's actually what makes the broken man's speech work, though. Having seen all of these different experiences through Brienne is what makes that speech work and so impactful. So it makes sense.
Yeah, it really contextualizes, if I could say that word.
Yeah.
you know, something, you know, everything that we've seen before, that speech does, you're right.
Yeah. Michael, you want to say?
Yeah, I wonder if Brienne, say, had been thinking in her mind throughout all of these chapters, all right, I'm going to the Vale, she might be in the Vale, and maybe in our minds her trajectory was a bit more certain. Whether it would have been more engaging, less engaging, what impact that would have had, because, yeah, when she thinks, oh, okay, let's go to the Cracklaw Point, yeah, we have that point. She ain't there, Sansa ain't there, no one's at Cracklaw Point.
Someone's a crack clop.
Yeah, but she thinks twice in this chapter that the Vale, if this doesn't turn out, I'm going to the Vale because that's where I think she is. But it's just she keeps getting hints that, oh, she might be here. So she's like, okay, I'll go here. But if it doesn't turn out, I'm going to the Vale.
Yeah,
but then she abandons it.
When she learns that Lysa's dead.
It has a quality of, like, you know, the guy who loses his car keys in the parking lot and he's looking for them under the streetlight, and they ask him, why do I think you're there? You know, why do you think the keys are there? And he's like, well, because I can see here.
Yep.
You know, because Brienne is not. That's another thing that I really love about this is, you know, Jaime gave Brienne this quest, and it's completely a in-character Jaime thing to do because he didn't really consider whether Brienne was kind of, you know, equipped for this. And she's really not. Like, she's, you know, I mean, yes, she sort of got him back to King's Landing after she promised to, and she's very resourceful, like, you know, when there's a river galley coming after her and she gets rid of it, you know, basically on her own. But she's not, like, worldly. You know, she's not great at, you know, like, talking to somebody like Dick Crab and sort of understanding, you know, how a person like Dick works. You know, and I should just say that also Nimble Dick Crab is my second favorite character.
I love his name. Like, his name is the best. But I think Brienne's naive, but I don't think she's stupid, and I think that's why she trusts Dick Crab and doesn't realize he's totally leading me on, or at least doesn't really suspect it in this part and continues to follow him. Whereas Jaime's a lot more jaded and is less likely to believe people.
Well, I also think that she, like, she's not stupid, and she might not even be that naive, but she also don't want to miss out on a lead. Like, she has so few of those that if she has something she can follow, well, she will follow it because she doesn't really have any other choice. And I think that's why she follows him. She doesn't really trust him or trust what he's saying, but just in case he's not lying.
Yeah, she's grasping at straws, and well, here's a straw.
And to be fair, it fits the bill. Like, it's a fool. It's got two other people. Like,
yeah.
She can't walk away from this information.
Although I noticed how George kind of, you know, he had Dick say, you know, because Brienne, like, you know, because again, Brienne is not experienced at doing this kind of thing. She's not stupid, but she's not experienced at, like, questioning people. And she, like, says, oh, you know, two girls with him, which is exactly what you shouldn't say in that situation. You know, you should not volunteer any information with your questions, but she doesn't know to do that. And Dick, you know, being a con man, picks up on that and is like, oh, yeah, could have been two girls. So, I never saw them exactly, but I bet it was two girls. And she doesn't sort of, you know, pick up on that. But I thought that was a really nice touch by George that, you know, she's sort of questioning him like a bad policeman.
Yeah. Okay, do you guys have any more points on Brienne, or should we move on to Arianne?
I had one thing on this chapter that
I
noticed, but not on the reread. I didn't realise Dickon was marrying Lord Mouton's daughter.
Oh, yeah.
So basically, Randall's taken over, like, he's actually taken over Maidenpool.
Mm-hmm.
Which was pretty cool.
Actually, yeah, it's cool. That surprised me a little when I read that today. It's that I would expect Randall Tarly to go for a higher match than the Lord of Maidenpool.
Yeah, a bit more ambitious.
Yeah.
Yeah, I've heard, and I don't know how much we want to get into theorizing here, but I've heard people theorize that that's part of him, you know, being a friend in the reach of the Golden Company, that, you know, the idea that he would want to control Maidenpool as a, you know, a good invasion spot or something. I don't know if I buy that 100%, but I've certainly heard people argue that.
Well, okay, yeah, I can see that, yeah.
I think as a port, it's valuable. And when you consider what a little bitch Lord Mutant is now, he's going to have real control. Because, yeah, if you've seen this chapter, he's just, like, looking out when Lord Tali is dispensing justice over his subjects.
He's watching this marriage.
Yeah. He's going to get complete control over Maidenpool, basically, with this marriage.
Is it really in character, though? I feel like we don't know Randall Tali very much, but we... Like, the way we see him act here, and even at Bitterbridge with Brienne, it's something, like, it's sexist and sadistic and all of that, but he's also acting like a good lord, like, that's also already, I mean, again, Bina saying this, he restores peace, he's rebuilding Maidenpool, he stops the whole bet on Brienne's Maidenhead, and even though he's not a very likable character, he seems to be an honorable one. So
he's
yeah.
Do you want to finish what you're saying? If you have,
well, I never finish my sentences. I'm really bad at this, so you can go.
Okay. No, I think he's the same as the person you work with who's a horrible person, but they're really good at their job. That's who he is. He's fantastic at his job. He's a great warrior. He's a great commander. He's very good at getting his subjects to do what he wants them to do. It's just he's a shit person.
Honestly, he reminds me of Tywin when he was Hand of the King and gave peace to the realm, in that neither one of these people are doing this, restoring the peace, because it's good for the small folk necessarily. They're just doing it because it maintains the order of feudal society. It prevents, you know, chaos. It ensures stability. He doesn't care about these small folk. They're just cogs to him, pawns to use to build up the foundation that he rests upon.
Yeah, that's very true.
I think they are definitely very, very similar similar characters in that, you know, and also in the fact that they have, like, these raging, you know, emotional problems behind all their, behind everything that they do, as far as, you know, Tywin's worry that they're going to be laughed at, and I think Randall is motivated a lot by, you know, thinking that the Tarleys should be a nobler house, because the Tarleys are obviously better than everyone.
Yeah.
Well, he's worried about Sam being laughed at multiple times. So, yeah, very similar. They're both terrible dads.
Mm-hmm. Yep. Okay. Anything else? I'll take that as a no. Okay,
one of the mutants and the Tarleys both Targaryen loyalists.
Yeah, that's true.
Our first mention of Sir Clarence Crabbe.
Yeah,
eight feet tall as well.
Okay, well, we can move on to Arya. I'll just finish with something that Bina notes, which I find really really a good thing. She says we actually see a feast for crows in this chapter, which is gruesome and terrible, but the title of this book is really accurate here.
That is a really good catch.
Yeah.
It's like in the movies when they say the name of the movie.
Yeah. Yeah. Okay, so after Brienne 3, we jump forward 90 pages and 6 chapters to Arianne 1, aka the Queenmaker. Arianne is around 24 years old at this point. And Michael, you have the recap.
All right, so here is the Queenmaker. Arianne is waiting in a desert ruin for Sir Aerys Okart to arrive with Princess Myrcella. She is with her friends Silver Santagar, Sir Andrey Dolt, and Garen of the Orphans, as well as Sir Gerald Dane, known as Darkstar. News from Plankytown tells of dragons in Karth, a slave rebellion in Astapor, and that the Golden Company has broken their contract with Maya for the first time in history. Arian knows that Quinton was seen travelling east with a maester and knights sworn to Lord Ironwood. She believes that the broken contract is significant and that Quinton means to use the Golden Company to usurp her as the heir to the Principality of Dorne. Darkstar comes to Arian and explains that her plan to crown Myrcella Queen of the Seven Kingdoms and provoke the Lannisters to war will not succeed in getting what she wants, but killing Myrcella will. Arian is shocked at the proposal and replies that Myrcella is under her personal protection and is not to be harmed. She also thinks it may have been a mistake to include Darkstar in this plan. Sir Aris arrives with Myrcella, with news that Tywin is dead, and that Sunspear believes Myrcella is currently indisposed with red spots. The crew of Seven then ride for the River Greenblood, while Arian reflects on her plan. In crowning Myrcella and gaining revenge against the Lannisters, she also seeks to free the Sand Snakes and assert herself as the rightful heir to rule Dorne. Arian knows that she is loved across Dorne, while Quinton is little known, and that the only obstacle to her plan may be House Ironwood, who may declare for him instead. As they arrive at the Orphan's pole boat, they are shocked to discover Doran Martell's bodyguard, Aerio Hotar, waiting for them with a complement of guards. Aerio commands them to yield, saying that elsewise he must slay them all but the princess and Arianne. The crew is ready to yield, but Sir Aerys refuses, and after giving Arianne a lingering look, charges headlong into certain doom. After being feathered with crossbow bolts, Aerys is swiftly beheaded by Aerio Hotar. Arianne falls from her saddle and retches, while Myrcella screams as Darkstar slashes her face before fleeing. Arianne thinks to herself that she has descended into a nightmare, and soon she will wake from her terrors. She asks Aerio how Doran could possibly have known their plans, as she had taken such care, to which Aerio replies, "Someone told. Someone always tells."
Great. Thanks. Yeah.
By the way, can I just say, we almost had some Myrcella water. Okay.
I was? A Myrcella water?
Yeah, you know how they have all the ads on TV about, oh, Myrcella water, take off your makeup, cleanse your face, all in one.
Oh, micell water. Yeah, yeah, I've seen that in the beauty aisle.
Yeah, that's the only thing I was thinking when I read her name. I was just like, come on.
Good.
Sorry.
Michael, did you have some talking points, maybe?
All right, so this is the first time we get to see Arianne from her viewpoint, and her opinion of all of her friends, Darkstar and Sir Aerys. What do we think of her as a character?
She's stupid. She's
kind of stupid, I think on some level she realizes that this plan is very desperate and brazen and fraught with peril. But on the other hand, I think she's blinded by her want for vengeance, and also the fact that she believes she's being dispossessed. That's causing her to do this
thing. To me, it feels more like fear than it feels vengeance. Like, I really think she fears to lose her heritage, and she doesn't want to lose Dorne, and she's afraid that Quentin is going to take over. So that's what drives her to do this. And also she wants to do something. She doesn't want to stay idle while her father dispossesses her, like she thinks is happening. But at the same time, that plan is really stupid, and that's not the worst thing about it to me. It's that it's also very cruel to Myrcella. Like, even if their plan had succeeded, it's just cruel. Like, it cannot end well for Myrcella. There's no way it's gonna be.
Even if they win, she'd be killing her brother and she'd be killing family members. It's
yeah.
Well, she doesn't want to kill any of them, and she thinks Tommen will just be Lord of Storm's End. And I do think that this is naive. Like, you can't make someone not be a king once they're king.
Yeah.
So she has good intentions.
I think her plan is very surface level. So I think it looks okay on paper, but she didn't think through the reality of it very much. And I think that's the problem with it. Sorry, Marie. Yeah.
Yeah, no, you're right. You're right. I just meant to say that, like, she has good intentions, but she really only thinks of herself in this. And, like, when Myrcella arrives and she's like, what's going on? And, but how, why do you want to crown me? I'm not a queen. Like, Tommen is king, and that's fine. Like, she's not, it's not really fair to this little girl who has done nothing to anyone, who's actually like a good girl. She's smart. She's wise. She's like, you want everything for her, but it's not fair to her. She's really only using Myrcella, and despite all of her best intentions, that's not fair.
Yeah. It's not. And I also think Aerys Okart is kind of silly to take Myrcella there, because he wasn't told the full plan, and he gets there and he's like, oh yeah, what's the rest of the plan?
Aerys is thinking with his penis.
Yeah, there's nothing else working at the moment.
Even if you're thinking with that, you could do a little better than Aerys does.
Yeah. He's like, hey, I bought you Myrcella. All right, let's make out. And Arian's like, what?
No, but seriously, he's as bad as she is because she brought Darkstar along. It's just like, oh yeah, he's super hot. Maybe I should make him my consort. And then in her head, she's going, but he has a cruel mouth with a crueler tongue, dark and angry eyes. He's a really bad person. But he's really hot, so like, let's make him my consort, yeah?
I think Arianne bringing Darkstar there represents her subconscious frustration that if this plan succeeds, she's going to have to marry Aerys. And, well, she doesn't hate Aerys. She gets along with him. It's clear that she's not in love with him, and she's not besotted with him. And Darkstar represents that sort of alternate, that contrast. It is stupid. It's very stupid.
It just reminds me of Dany and her decisions. And I'm like, oi, man.
There's definite parallels there.
Yeah.
Yeah, but you know, like, there's almost a 10 years difference between Arian and Dany. Like, 8. Like, Dany must be, what, 16 at this point?
Probably.
And, yeah, I mean, I get the sense where that she's Arian... coming from. But I don't have a lot of sympathy, at least yet. I think this is a turning point for Arianne, and next time we see her, I'm going to like her more, because she'll be, oh my God, what have I done? But right now, nope.
The parallel I actually thought of with this, with Arianne here was, you know, and you guys are going to think this is mean, but was Cersei. Because, you know, they're both...
Well, she's using sex, yeah.
Cersei trusts the Kettleblacks because they're pretty, and Arianne trusts Darkstar because he's pretty?
It's because she's power-hungry.
That too.
No, it's because she... I think, you know, when you get Cersei's POV and you sort of see her starting to try to scheme, you know, she thinks of herself as this great schemer, but really, she's just kind of been sitting on the sidelines her whole life, like thinking, well, I'm smart. I could do so much better than my dad or Robert, of course. And, you know, she probably could do better than Robert. But you know, it's just somebody who's like trying to play the Game of Thrones when they've never really played before, but they don't quite realize that they're inexperienced and they don't know. And they don't quite know what they're doing, but they also don't realize that they don't quite know what they're doing. Like, you know, it seems like Arianne was, you know, not kept in her father's counsels as much as she should have been if, you know, she was, you know, because we find out later, you know, she's supposed to rule Dorne. So she really needed to be, you know, kind of brought along as a ruler much better, and her father kind of didn't do that.
Yeah, well, yeah, that's I definitely another...
blame that on Doran.
Like, yes.
It's almost as if Arianne has been living in an extended adolescence, but if she'd been told this plan, this very important plan, that would have caused her to mature and start thinking in terms of Game of Thrones, let's roll the dice and stuff. But yeah, so part of this is Doran's fault.
Mm-hmm. Well, and it's not just the, you know, the big, you know, the big Doran Martell master plan thing either. It's like, it doesn't seem like Arianne is particularly involved in like the governance of Dorne. Like, you don't get her, you know, at any point sort of thinking about stuff like that. So, you know, why isn't she, you know, being pushed into doing the kind of things that Ned pushes Rob into doing?
Yeah, to like having the training wheels, getting them trained up so
exactly. that
later on they are ready and will make good decisions. Yeah, definitely.
And she seems like she's really motivated by trying to like she wants to be taken seriously too, I think. Which I think is perhaps bred some by that, you know, she's just kind of being left over here as the princess and she's not getting the, you know, and she's not sort of a part of everything.
You see in the previous chapter with Aerys, she mentions the various duties that Doran gave to all the people at Sunspear. Like someone got to take the accounts, the seneschal got to take the management of the castle, and all she got actually was manage the feasts and frolics and entertain the guests. And it's something that quite annoys her. And then she vents to Aerys. So yeah.
Yeah.
I can imagine a lot of frustration in her.
Yeah. Yeah, and as well, we can't really expect her to grow up and act with a better head on her shoulders if she's never had to or had the opportunity to.
Yeah, for sure.
It'd be nice if she could figure that out, but...
Yeah, apparently she hasn't yet. But I do think that this chapter is going to be, like... I mean, I'm not going to talk about... Winds of Winter preview chapters, or maybe we can talk about them at the end, but I'm not even sure that's interesting. But I do think that Arianne is going to be an interesting character later, and she has a role to play. And I think that's the point where she's going to start growing and learning. And we needed to see her this way, maybe to really understand how she is afterwards. And so actually, Bina had a question here. So Arianne thinks that Quentin couldn't usurp her with a bigger army because she is better loved in Dorne. Like, it doesn't matter that he has the Golden Company, people don't know him. Is that naive? Does, like...
Very.
Yeah, Bina's question is, doesn't still count for more than smiles? And I think she answers her own question with the way she phrases it. Like, yeah, I would believe that if Quentin really wanted to usurp her, the fact that she's better known in Dorne wouldn't really matter.
I would say it would.
It would depend how.
Because her reputation... Yeah, like the certain lords and ladies would rise for her and pledge their arms to her if she was more popular. And if Quentin comes in with this foreign army, because that's what the Golden Company is at this point, there would be a lot of xenophobia and, oh, who's this? What are they doing? We need to get rid of them. So I think she has a point.
Right, is, you know, you come in with a superior army and you defeat them and then, you know, they... pour scorpions into your bed and
well, gone. that's true. You have a good point in it. She's not completely wrong, but the Golden Company is what, 10,000 strong? I think Dorne is quite scarcely populated, which, yeah, you're right, has been enough to stop bigger armies before, obviously, but this would be a more complicated issue because Quentin would not be a stranger. So I could see, and I mean, we know what kind of person Arian is at this point. I could see her believing that she's well loved and known in Dorne when actually people like don't necessarily really side with her because, I mean, Dorne is less sexist than the rest of Westeros, but it doesn't mean that there are not some people who would be like, well, yeah, you know, and actually she's a woman and she hasn't done much yet, so why not Quentin?
The Golden Company is a massive army in as well. So even if some of the small folk rise up for her, they could easily just kill them. Like, sorry, but
well, that's what's given going that on Dorne is a desert. Question. And it is an arid land. I don't know how well a whole army of 10,000 would do, like, against a guerrilla fighting force. This is traditionally how Dorne has won their battles. They've not met Essos, as massive armies.
Isn't Essos a lot more like Dorne, though, than Westeros, though, the rest of Westeros? So the Golden Company might be better equipped to fight in Dorne than most other armies are.
I don't know. Elephants need a lot of water is sort of my bet. Not that I'm an elephant keeper, but...
Well, but actually, like, this whole thing, even in Arian... nightmare of Quentin usurping her place, it doesn't even really make sense because the idea would be that Doran would back up Quentin. So why wouldn't, I mean, if like maybe he would need an army to just assure his position, but if from the get-go Doran is like, well, yeah, no, you're not going to get Arian. I'm naming Quentin my heir. Would there really be a civil war in Dorne?
No, well, he's the lord. And his word is final.
Yeah.
But when you start messing with Order of Inheritance, which is the fundamental core to the feudal system, that's a big deal. Like the Dance with Dragons, that's when they started messing with it. And... various other wars of inheritance, like, so other lords might then go, oh, or maybe ladies will go, oh, well, if I back this move, am I going to get disinherited? So I think it is a big deal to take the firstborn son, for want of a better word, with the secondborn.
Yeah, you're right.
Yeah, and I mean, there's always, you know, and I think there's certainly plenty of families in Dorne that would maybe welcome a chance to kind of improve their situation and, you know, don't necessarily have any particular love for the Martells, you know, so I don't think they would just be like, well, Doran says.
Yeah.
Well, isn't that why he's doing this?
Why he's doing...
They're going to make Quentin and betroth him to the Yornwood.
Well, that was to... That was to make good on the blood debt when Oberyn killed their lord and poisoned him.
Oh, that was a forced run.
Yeah, the idea was to restore the peace between the Ironwoods and the Martells. Okay, what else do you guys have to say about Arian?
Who told? Who was the teller?
Oh, yeah.
I think it's the orphan because none of his men are there, but...
They all seem so loyal to her.
Or it might not even be one of them. It could be one of the orphans from the boats, though, because they had to have known at least some of what was happening to be there.
Yeah.
Do you think it was Aerys and that's why he was so willing to give up his life?
No, because otherwise he wouldn't have given up his life.
If he had told about this, he would have been like, oh, yep, laying down my sword. Oh, no, Arian, we've been foiled. Oh, so bad.
I mean, if he had told about this, he wouldn't even have taken Missala. Like, he just would have sent the Aerio Hota to the rendezvous point. That would have worked just as well to to catch Arianne.
Do you think Micella and Eris's fakes back in the room that told?
Yeah. Maybe he told them too much about... Well, the thing is, he didn't know, actually.
He didn't really know
the plan. So even him being an idiot, he couldn't have blabbed it to someone.
That is true.
I think it's kind of a tease by George, because in the next chapter, Arianne's going to say, oh, it had to be one of my three friends, Silver, Dre, or Garen. But we really don't know anything about these three, so it's not much of a... You can't make good theories out of it when, they're just indistinguishable characters at this point.
Mm-hmm. Well, maybe you're right, it's Garen, because what happens to the three of them afterwards?
Garen gets exiled to Tarosh.
Oh, right.
Dre goes to Norvos, and Silver goes to Estamont to wed Lord Estamont.
Who's like 70.
Yeah, he's an old man. Yeah.
I've always thought that, just based on the narrative trajectory, that Silver was the one who did it, because Garen and Dre are basically out of the narrative. We're probably not going to see them again, unless, I don't know, maybe Danny goes by Tarosh, but unlikely. Whereas Silver is right in the Stormlands. That's where Arianne's going, and it's where, conveniently, the Golden Company is going to land, and Arianne's making a beeline to the Golden Company. So I just feel like they need to have that conversation, the dramatic revelation. That, again, doesn't really mean much because we don't know Silver Sandekar.
I'll buy that.
Yeah. I like your theory.
I feel like I'm cheating, though. Again, I'm not basing this on Silver's characteristics.
Well, we don't have any characteristics. Yeah. So it's the best theory.
She has freckles. She's really annoyed they keep making fun of her for her freckles.
Yeah.
Doesn't it seem like an of the night type of thing to do? To tell. So my money's on Darkstar.
That's true.
I don't get Darkstar. Like, I just... What? He's just...
He's such a prick.
Yeah.
He's an emo character. Like, just... God. Teenagers.
It would make but sense, though, for him.
He's not a teenager.
He acts like one...
It would make sense, given that his plan was to
kill Marcella.
To kill Marcella and start a war. It would make some sense for him to tell and then, be ready to act when
in the chaos.
To run in the chaos and hoping that, more chaos would happen. Like, he starts this little fight and, maybe Arianne even gets hit by a stray crossbow bolt or something, and it's just a complete mess. So given that Darkstar's goal seems to be chaos, I kind of think it was him. But whether he would have known the full details of the plan, I'm not sure.
Well, he might have, because Arianne said that they needed Darkstar for his castle.
Yeah.
So potentially he knew the whole plan. So yeah.
Yeah.
But right after that, Silver says, there are other lords with other castles,
Mm-hmm. Yeah, but from the beginning, but obviously Arianne trusts him for some reason,
because he's hot.
To some extent. Yeah, because he's hot, basically. So, I mean, my God, when she thinks about the very beautiful children they would have, I was like, oh, come on, please.
She's like Sansa, though, in the Game of Thrones. That's what it's like.
Yeah, but again, like, more than a 10-year difference.
But she's never had to grow up.
I mean, Dan, you were making the parallel with Cersei? Or Michael? Sorry, I forgot.
I think that was Dan making the comparison with Cersei.
Yeah, well, when Cersei sees...
Orane
Waters, yeah. She has the same kind of thought, like,
Stop thinking with your back. People, stop thinking with your genitals, okay? Like, that's what it needs to be said. You can go sleep with them, but don't keep them on your council.
Yeah.
Like,
everybody just needs a bucket of water thrown on them.
Cold showers all around. I forgot how much of a douche Darkstar was when he's introducing himself to Marcella.
I think
he makes
George
such a big
has...
deal of going to piss.
Yeah. While I was pissing, yeah. I was thinking. Oh, he's such a dick.
The sand was very grateful. Come on.
Yeah.
Just please.
Who is... All right, here's one for you. Who's more of a douche then? Heil Hunt or Darkstar?
Darkstar. Heil Hunt's funny.
Even though Heil Hunt was a tit, though. He was involved in... He was, like, the main conspirator in the whole Brienne wager.
Heil Hunt
know,
was mean to Brienne,
so I'm gonna
hate him more.
He didn't try to kill a child.
And fail at it.
Is this the only...
kill a little girl.
Yeah,
you know, I ended up just cutting off her ear. Poor kiddo.
So if he's the one who told, did he think he could take Arya Hotter?
Oh yeah.
No, he runs away like a bitch.
Well, it's because he's got loads of men with him. But if it was a more equal fight,
he seems pretty delusional. So
yeah,
I think I've always thought Arya was a bit of a badass.
Yes,
I think.
Yeah, but like. Darkstar is just, yeah. He believes he can take anyone, basically.
Well, we might see Darkstar it in the Wings of Winter, because Arya is sent to hunt down Darkstar with Obara and Balon Swan.
Yeah,
and Arya's had a chapter, so we'll get a point of view.
Yes.
Cool. Do you have anything else to say about Arya, or can we move on to Jon?
One very quick thing. Mm-hmm. Marcella has turned out so well for being raised by Cersei, don't you think?
Yeah. Yeah.
Oh yeah. That's great.
Is that a miracle of just lack of Cersei involvement?
Well,
yeah, I get the impression Tommen and Marcella have been ignored a bit by Cersei. Like Joffrey got the lion's share of corruption.
We were discussing this actually in episode 66, which I'm editing and isn't out at the moment. And basically what came out was, well, yeah, basically the best you can hope with Cersei as a mother is that she ignores you. And that's what she kind of ignored Marcella and Tommen. But it's still incredible because, as Tanya was saying, it's still not a very good way of parenting.
That's
your
best motherly virtue.
I know, I think
we need to throw in a little symbol crash there for Michael and the lion's share, though.
Yeah.
Oh, pun not even intended.
Sorry, what were you saying, though, Sarah? I think I talked over you.
But no, it's fine. With Marcella and Tommen, it's not like they were completely unattended, though, because they did have scepters taking care of them. So they were taken care of. They weren't completely ignored. It's just Cersei was nowhere near them, thankfully.
Thank God.
Raised by literally anyone but Cersei.
Yeah. Pretty much. Yeah.
Yeah. But yeah, she turned out great. And actually, it's in episode 65, I think, that I was listening a few days ago. Bina was asking, what do you think? Is Marcella gonna die? So maybe you guys have opinions and theories about that to add to those who have already answered.
I think I was on that one, so I'll abstain.
Okay.
I said she's dead. Or she dying soon.
I think everyone said that.
Well, it's the prophecy, isn't it?
Yeah.
Yeah.
You've got the reverse of plot armor. It's like plot death.
Yeah.
Plot holy armor.
Well, she must have a use, otherwise George would have just killed her here. There must be something further from her.
Yeah. I hope. She's an interesting character. I mean, She's just a good girl. You don't want to see her dead.
Yeah, I'd quite like to see her survive, marry Tristane and be happy.
Play more Cersei.
Yeah. Okay, moving on to John. This way, if Tanya ever arrives, she will only talk about John, which will make her very happy, I'm sure.
All right, so this is supposed to be me, huh?
Yeah, so that's the first John chapter in Dance, same day as the two previous chapters. And yeah, it's you, Dan.
All right, well, we start off with John is sleeping / warging ghost, and we get some of that fun wolf writing that Martin likes to give us, as far as, you know, looking at the wall as the white cliff and stuff like that. I always really like how he's, you know, he writes in wolf in some of these scenes. And you get lots of snow, yelling snow, presumably from the raven, or is it Blood Raven? And John gets an intelligence report on what the other wolves are up to through Ghost, which he seems to remember a lot clearly, more clearly than Arya remembers her warging, I noticed. There are badass goats wherever Shaggy Dog is, and the wall blocks warging, so he can't sense Summer. We get the idea underlined to us again that someone can survive in their wolf, almost like that's going to be important in the future. Then the raven, the raven wakes John up, and we get told about how it ate Mormont's face, apparently. Gross there, Blood Raven. Though that seems like a weird thing to notice when you're fleeing murderous mutineers, so it could be raven slander. John says, that bird is too clever by half, and I yell at myself, because it's Blood Raven.
Of course.
Then we get Dolorous Ed arrives, and, you know, everyone, please clap for Dolorous Ed.
Yay!
And we get Dolorous Ed's thoughts on prunes and cooks, which are negative. Never trust a cook, my lord. They'll prune you when you least expect it. I think having a Dolorous Ed's, quote, alarm clock seems like a really great product, and I think George should get on that. We hear John get his update on wildling prisoner matters and find out he has to skip breakfast to go see Stannis. We get the first hint of John disliking keeping guards and other signs of rank, such as not living in Donald Noy's old shack, which, you know, becomes kind of a problem later on. Then he goes into the yard, and it's neat to see that John has – one of the first things that John has done, unlike the people in King's Landing, is made sure that the recruits are getting trained really well and put someone who's actually good at it in that job on, you know, rather than, say, Alistair Thorne. I thought that was a neat detail where John is like, yeah, we're doing this right, you know, because he was so recently trained himself. But then we get Godfrey, quote, a knight of great renown, to hear him tell it, unquote, Faring, who is just the fucking worst. Mm-hmm. Gotta be one of the worst characters we meet. John then sees Sam, who's been reading books about archery he's supposed to practice, because he is Sam. And then he goes up to see Stannis and Melisandre. So we start off with Stannis by him complaining about Lyanna Mormont, and we get the classic, Bear Island knows no king but the king in the north, whose name is Stark. You know, and you sort of hear trumpets in the background when you read that, or at least I do.
Yeah.
I always hear, like, cheering.
Then Stannis complains some more. John remembers he turned down being a Stark. Stannis utters the, as we later learn, rather ironic line, is Arnulf Karstark the only man of honor in the North? And complains that John doesn't talk enough. He then offers the wonderful Stannis line of, just once, you might try to give me an answer that would please me, Lord Snow. I love Stannis, just insane peevishness at all times. John then explains some northern politics and explains how wildlings work. Stannis mentions that he's been learning about the others from Mance, but that won't stop him from executing him. And Stannis complains. I like the quote from John is, Stannis Baratheon with a grievance was like a mastiff with a bone. He gnawed it down to splinters. Stannis then complains about Gilly and says, I'll have more milk from her and less messages. John then explains how Craster worked, which apparently seems to upset Stannis, and we get, I will not suffer such abominations it's from your stomach, abominations here. This is not King's Landing. Presumably this is another one of Stannis' unrecognized jokes that no one laughs at.
It's a good joke.
And it's Stannis delivered then, totally deadpan.
Yeah. Yeah, imagine Stannis like standing at an open mic. Like,
he'd be great though. So good.
Stannis then complains about the food the Watch has given him. Stannis and Jon wrangle about the castles, and we get the, you know, various back and forth there, and Stannis threatens to behead Jon and waves his fakey sword around, which seems a little sort of demonstrative for Stannis. Then we get Jon and Melisandre walking away from the conference, and Jon says the wonderful line about Stannis of, he only threatened to behead me twice. And Mel calls the wall one of the hinges of the world, which seems like a, you know, one of those underlined lines again. And then she ends by dropping the line of, you know nothing, Jon Snow. So apparently she can see some stuff in her fires.
Yeah. Or maybe he just really knows nothing.
Like anyone, I mean,
I'm wearing a you know nothing Jon Snow top, so funny. Okay, sorry.
I mean, it's all there. It's all in this chapter. Like, first Jon chapter, and you have everything leading to Jon's death, and maybe and probably surviving in his wolf thing, and
Melisandre's already seeing visions of daggers in the dark. He needs to keep Ghost by him.
Yep.
It's right there.
It's all here. Yep. It's like first chapter of the book.
Yeah, by rereading it, that stuff all does just like flash like a neon sign.
Yeah.
And the stuff with his wolf as well. The worgen. Yes.
Yeah.
Oh, by the way, with the wolf stuff, with the goats having the massive horns and being enormous, did anybody else go, are they the unicorns?
Yeah.
I did when someone pointed it out to me on a theory. I didn't pick it up myself. But yeah, it only mentioned one horn.
On the first read, I probably didn't pick it up either. Today, it seemed like a good... Skagos. Unicorns.
Yeah, Skagos. Definitely.
Does anyone have an opinion on the wall and its warg blocking abilities or possible magic blocking abilities? Because now that Summer's on the other side, he can't really detect what Summer's doing.
But is it because Summer's north of the wall, or is it because Summer's where the Children of the Forest are and Blood Raven? I almost said White Raven.
It's the wall.
Blood Raven.
Is that true? Like, I don't know. I don't have the timeline in front of me. Do we know if that's true? Like, is someone in the cave at this point?
In the next one, it's Bran hasn't reached Blood Raven yet. They're still on the way.
Okay.
I think.
I was so close.
Yeah. Haven't reached the cave yet.
So I think it is the wall. Sorry.
It would have been a great theory.
Well, yeah, I think it's hinted at that it's the wall, but there was, I don't remember who, but there was someone on the forums who was disagreeing with that, and he brought up good points. I think it's maybe George isn't very clear on what the wall is blocking, and it's not very clear to me, but the first interpretation is surely that that's because he's north of the wall.
But the thing is, doesn't Faramir Sixskin have his eagle? I think it is fly over the wall and scout.
Yeah, Yeah.
So it obviously still works. So whether it's the amount of distance between them.
Hi, Tanya.
Hi.
Hello.
Hello.
You're just in time. We just moved on to John.
God, no, I'm going to hang up. Bye.
Okay.
Bye, Tanya.
I haven't been on one with a John chapter in a really long time, actually.
That's good, that's good. We have some John lovers and John haters here. And Stannis lovers as well.
He's a John lover.
I love John.
Oh,
I really
okay.
like John.
I take back any offers of letting you stay with me ever.
Actually, I like John, I think, better. I didn't hate John in this chapter. I thought he was quite good in this chapter. And I'm like, you know what? You're getting better, bro. You're getting better.
Yeah, exactly.
No, I do hate him less as things continue. His last chapter is fine with me. No, I do genuinely hate him a bit less as things progress, I guess. So,
yeah.
That's good. So I won't be as angry as
growing as a person.
That's not...
Yeah, exactly. Right. I like him in this chapter because... And in basically the chapters from Dance, because we see him being a ruler and a leader, and I think he does that pretty well. I guess it's debatable given the fact that his own people is stabbing him in the back later, but quite literally. But I do think that he's more leveled and he's out of his whiny self.
My main problem with John is always that I've always found his chapters and his actions and like everything that happens in his chapters way too predictable, and like him becoming Lord Commander to me was obvious from possibly the first chapter in the book. I don't know. It's been there was nothing surprising about that, right? But I do, once he does become Lord Commander, I do find that things become better in that sense, that I was genuinely surprised by some of his actions and some of the things that happened in his chapters, and I started finding them genuinely interesting once I kind of got over the fact that I have to change
stop
my perspective.
Yeah.
I mean, I can't say I like him, but I do. But I hated his chapters in the earlier books, and once he becomes Lord Commander, I actually don't. So yeah, so I'm not going to be too angry on this episode.
Yay!
John's leadership, you know, even though he fails, you know, because you can't get anything done if you have a knife in your back and you're dead, he sort of fails kind of reasons that, you know, are sort of sympathetic.
Yeah, all of those things
they're
he does, they're very justifiable. And I think his problem is he just doesn't explain his justifications for his all the stuff he does to the people who are grieving and being like, nah, you can't let the wildlings through, nah.
Yeah,
well, I also think that he could have explained it, but it would still not have been enough because it's the kind of political brave decisions that you have to make, and in our world it just means that you won't get reelected. In John's world it means that you will be assassinated, and that's, I mean, I'm not sure anyone could have taken those decisions, which I think are the right decisions. Like in the big picture, it's the right thing to let the wilding come south, but
mm-hmm.
I mean, see how it's ever going to be accepted by the Night's Watch.
I feel like he's in one of those situations that we do see in real life politics quite a lot as well, mm-hmm. where someone takes over power in a moment where everything is already really screwed up, and there's really, the situation is so bad that there's really no good way out of this, and any way forward is going to make people dislike you to some extent, because people also just dislike the situation that you haven't necessarily caused, but because you're in power now, you're going to get all the hate for everything that happens. And I feel like it's one of those situations where you just can't win, basically. Like, you can't be liked if you come to power in certain situations, I think.
Yeah, which is very true. Because if you get into power in a bad situation, everyone just... it can continue, and especially if you have to make very difficult decisions because of that situation, you're still blamed for them.
Yeah, and you can't immediately fix everything. Like, John isn't, like, this is such a shitty situation that the Night's Watch is in, and there's no good and easy and comfortable immediate fix for this. So he's obviously going to be hated however things develop, because he can't immediately fix it. So it's just a difficult situation for him to take over in.
It is a difficult situation, but he also didn't do a lot of the things that, you know, we're starting to get hints of right away, where he didn't, you know, sort of use the command, the power of the Lord Commander's office as far as, you know, really, really, you know, having guards around him. You know, for one, having guards around would make it harder for you to be assassinated, and just, you know, acting the Lord a little bit more might have helped people kind of, you know, accept his decisions and things like that. So, I mean,
yeah, no, this is not to say he couldn't have made things, like, he could have made better decisions, obviously, but yeah. But I feel
like he could have sold his decisions a little better.
Yeah.
Yeah, because he could have explained why he's making decisions, and, like, to his core advisors, and have core advisors, and trust them and listen to them. But,
yeah, we never see John's council meeting, you know? That's a really good point.
Yeah.
Yeah, he does unnecessarily isolate himself to an extent that's not helping him.
He sends a lot of his friends away, like Pip and Gren and various other people go to different castles, so when it comes time for his assassination, he really doesn't have anyone to protect him. I mean, even Ghost as jail is in a cell.
But I mean, we see him interacting with Bowen Marsh or other people of importance at Castle Black and trying to explain to them why he's making those decisions. But at some point, he just gives up on that because they don't get it. And he hopes that they will respect him enough to just do what he says, but they don't quite.
Yeah, but that's not leadership, though.
That's true, but I mean, when you see his conversations with Bowen Marsh, just kind of want to slap the guy. Like, just get real. The wildlings have to go through. And I think it was really a difficult situation, and people were not going to accept it anyway.
Honestly, yeah. Bowen Marsh should have been removed from his command as head steward. Like, he's just a negative Nancy. No one wants that.
Just be like, you're a negative Nancy, go to a different castle. Goodbye.
But yeah, seriously, he, as the Lord Steward, he's fighting John every step of the way. There has to be someone you can put in that's going to at least be partial to your orders. And what is it called? The Machiavellian ruling is, don't put your enemies in positions of power to take revenge against you.
Yeah, Dolor said wouldn't have complained less, but it still would have been better.
Yeah. With Bowen Marsh being in that position, because the stewards are very, very close to the Lord Commander and they need to work together so much, it's a bad position to put him in.
But he kind of turns him into an enemy, though.
Yeah.
By not even giving him a little win here or there, he just constantly shuts him down.
Mm-hmm.
Yep.
Maybe let's try not to discuss all the John chapters at once and stay on this one. So maybe everything with Stannis, because that's also something great in those John chapters. At least I really enjoy their dialogues. They're really funny.
Best.
Yeah.
Top notch banter.
Yeah.
Stannis fanboys all the way.
But actually, that's Bina is asking. She's asking. I mean, she's interesting to hear how the Stannis fanboys defend him going straight to threatening to kill Jon if he doesn't obey, and his bigoted reactions to the Night's Watch and Gilly on hearing that her father raped her. Shouldn't the first reaction be pity rather than abhorrence? And that's what I didn't think I would use, but Bina used it, so I'm reading.
But I don't think it's he raped her as much as that's his daughter that he married. Like,
yeah, but married, that's not
raped.
That's like, not Gilly's fault.
Combo. It's not Gilly's fault, but like, I think Stannis's reaction to everything and to
everything that's not pristine is get that away from me. So
Stannis is a hard really man. Bad way doesn't to put have, it. He doesn't have room for pity.
Yep.
Yeah, I should say, you know, Stannis fanboying, I think, has to, you know, it's kind of like cat ownership. You have to accept a certain amount of yowling and clawing of things that you wouldn't like clawed. And, you know, why did you take a shit in the bathtub, Stannis? Good question.
You have a really it's bad not cat. Even
anything. I don't have a really bad cat. I have a cat.
Yeah, no, my cat is giving me hell.
Any
as well.
Of that stuff. Like, my cat is the best behaved cat ever.
Well, you're lucky. Yeah, but I get what you're saying, Dan. Stannis, I mean, I love him as well, but I'm not sure I love the character really. I mostly love this kind of interactions because it's just, he's funny. He's like, mm-hmm. He doesn't want to be funny, but he surely is. And I enjoy reading those dialogues. But he's kind of he's kind of a douche. Also.
I mean, there's different ways of liking characters, right? You can enjoy the way a character is written and can enjoy reading about them without, like, wanting to hang out with them as a person or necessarily thinking they're a good guy or whatever.
Yep.
We all enjoyed Jaime Lannister, and even that was before his redemption.
Yes.
His redemption is the most overrated thing in this book, but that's a whole different chapter.
We should be friends. Hello. You can be on this podcast more often.
Okay, Stannis.
So, yeah, I do think Stannis was very much out of line when he's like, you know, I could take these castles by force, so you should give them to me. And Jon has to explain, you know, these are the castles of the Night's Watch. If you give them to your men as, you know, vassal castles, that you're going to turn the northern men against you. You're going against this very old and ancient institution. And I think, what do they eventually agree to? John's like, I'll garrison them myself. And Stannis is like, if they're not garrisoned by the year, I'll take them by force. But yeah,
Stannis. Yeah, sort of an ongoing negotiation there where they're like, you know, where John's like, well, give me the men and I'll, you know, and give me off and I'll give them officers so they can still be technically nice Night's Watch castles, but they'll be, you know, garrisoned. It's interesting listening to Stannis here. You know, kind of bounce off John because Davos isn't around. And it was interesting to see how John sort of had gotten into the Davos role here of telling Stannis when he's wrong. And it's interesting how Stannis just consistently needs somebody to do that.
Well, and like all kings.
Well, everyone needs advisors. I mean, if you're in a position
kings
of power,
and queens, they need
just to
good,
check yourself.
Good men.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, Stannis seems to need it. You know, extra though is what I'm thinking.
Well, I'm thinking he's pulling his sword and stuff on him because he's still pissed that he turned down becoming Jon Stark. I mean, that must really fucking piss Stannis off.
Well, everything really fucking pisses Stannis off, but he certainly complains about it enough.
That would have potentially saved his bacon, and he would have had the entire North behind him, or at least, you know, 2/3, 3/4.
It would have saved his bacon massively.
So I think he's entitled to wave his fancy sword around and, you know, just throw his toys out the pram and have a sulk.
It's also immediately after John says, "I am the sword in the darkness," or something, one of the oaths of the Night Watch. So it was really appropriate. Like, this is the real sword in the darkness. And I'm like, yeah, you get a point. And it makes me think, did George intentionally, like, know this conversation was going to happen? And so he made the Night's Watch oath to be kind of like that. And how far ahead did George think when he wrote this?
That's impossible. Like,
yeah, he's going to know.
He geared a whole plot towards this one scene.
So yeah, I mean, this much planning was comedic moments.
Just a little tip of the hat.
Yeah, and the Night's Watch vows are so great and badass in themselves. That would be a shame to write some things into them just to make it go with a certain conversation 5 books away. So no, I don't think so.
Yeah, I agree. This conversation doesn't seem big enough for this, and the vows seem too big in comparison. So doubt it. But it fits together really nicely. So,
what did I like about this conversation? Apart from everything.
John's like, just being honest. He's just laying it out.
Yeah. And like Stannis, he's like he's tactics smart, but he's not understanding human beings smart.
Yeah, he's Stannis is not people smart at all, which is why he works so well with Davos, because Davos is the person who is kind of puts it so the other person can see what they're trying to get across. So he's like the middleman. He translates for everyone. And it's like, Melisandre's there. Why doesn't she, you know, start translating? Instead, John has to do it. And I think John does a really good job of it. And I like how Mel, when they're leaving, Mel says, you know, Stannis is really starting to like you. And it's like, yeah, because he's being Davos for him. That's why.
He only tried to behead, he only threatened to behead me twice.
I love this part.
Yeah.
Well, Stannis loves Davos and he cut off his fingers, so... Imagine how much he loves John if he cuts off his head. So much.
Hey, we've just heard about the whispers and how that can be actually really great. So, you know, your chorus of heads.
He already has a witch to do it, so it's going to happen.
I have a new Winds of Winter theory.
John comes back as a talking head.
I still hope he doesn't come back. I'm sure he does, but I still hope. I'm still hoping he doesn't come back.
Actually, when did this come out? Sorry.
2011.
After J.K. Rowling, Prisoner of Azkaban, which does have talking heads. Sorry, just... Yeah, okay.
So derivative.
Okay, let's talk about Melisandre also. One of Bina's notes is that she respects Mel for her self-awareness that her interpretation of prophecy can be wrong. She says that in this chapter. So she does realize it.
Well, she says other people or the seer of the flames can make a mistake. I don't know if she's necessarily saying I make mistakes.
Mm-hmm.
But at least she acknowledges that visions are fallible, though. Rather than being like, it's a vision, it has to come true. They only ever come true in the way the seer interprets them.
What do you think is Melisandre's motivation to help John?
Seeing him in the flames?
That or just she
the
knows.
Fact that he's offering genuinely good advice to Stannis.
I think she can magically sense that, you know, there's some power to this guy, whether she quite understands, you know, warging and magic Targaryen blood and all that stuff, you know, super well. I think she's able to magically sense that, you know, like, wow, he's woo-woo. Just like the wall is wow, woo-woo.
Well, maybe magic begets, like, magic draws magic, so.
Yeah, but what does it mean for she backs Stannis. She thinks that Stannis is the prince that was promised. At least she says that's what she believes. So where does John, where is John in this interpretation? I feel that at least for the time being, she helps him because she thinks he's a good thing for the wall, and the wall is the most important thing to keep the others from invading. She's not necessarily helping him for him, but for the stability of the Night's Watch.
Yeah, it might be that she's realized partway through that maybe Stannis isn't the prince that was promised. Like, maybe the visions have changed because everything else around it has changed. And so she's still saying it's it's Dannis, but in the back of her mind she's going, I don't think it actually is anymore. But she's still backing him.
Maybe she's like subconsciously figured out to some extent, but
she might just be doubting herself now. But yeah. Okay. Michael and Dan.
It could be like, oh, I'm sure it's Dannis, but just in case it's not. So it could just be a keeping options open kind of thing.
Yeah.
One thing I wanted to bring up about Mel was that I think it's real interesting that her, like, the magic that she's using to glamour herself to look like Melisandre, you know, whatever she would actually look like without it, it's interesting that that magic gives off heat. Because she's, like, super hot. John describes.
Yes, she is.
Described. Not just in the way Grease Van Houten is super hot, but in other ways.
But is she super hot?
I don't know if that's
hot
the same
because...
magic. Like, that you have the glamour, and then
That's what I'm saying, though, because Stannis' sword doesn't give off any heat. It just glows. So that glamour, there's no heat or there's no anything but a shiny glamour, whereas Melisandre's glamour is apparently something extra because she gives off heat, and that was what I noticed and thought was interesting.
Could it just be because it's different quantities? Because, like, making the whole person...
I think it's an entirely different magic, like a different spell, because we know that followers of R'hllor, like Victarion's helper, they don't need to eat or drink. And so I think that's some different form of sustenance or the warmth of the Lord of Light being within them. So I think that's completely different to the glamours.
I agree with Michael on this. Yeah, I think it's different. I don't think just because she is glamour doesn't mean that's necessarily why she is always warm and giving off heat.
Mm.
Because if the glamours did have heat, you'd think she'd put one on the sword. Like, that's one of the things, like, you know, in underline, the sword gives off heat.
Mm-hmm.
Stannis complained that he was always too hot, so she took it off.
Stannis complained that she's always down. Too hot.
Ooh. Upgrade.
Ooh!
Sorry.
Sorry, not sorry.
Come on, it was so easy.
Yeah. Okay, any last points on John and Stannis and this chapter? Good. Okay. For those following along at home, the next episode of the reread will be hosted by Bina. Actually, it has already been hosted. It's recorded. And it will cover Bran 1, Sam 1, and John 2 from Dance, Feast, and Dance, respectively. You can follow us as usual on Instagram, Facebook, YouTube, Twitter, iTunes, WordPress, by searching for Vassals of Kingsgrave. And if you want to get involved and join us on a podcast or just chat, you can search for A Podcast of Ice and Fire and join the forums. And we will be happy to discuss with you. Thank you, everyone. It was great, really fun, and really glad to have you all today, especially Dan for his first reread.
Woo!
Thank you very
and
much.
And such a great chapter summary.
Yeah, well like, done.
It was very interactive.
Yep.
Oh, thank you very much.
I missed it.
Well, you can listen to it.
I will.
Soon, yeah. I hope. Cool. Okay, well, that's done. It was fun talking to you guys.
Yeah, see you soon. It was so nice talking to everyone.
Right. Yeah.
Bye.
Okay, bye.
Bye.
Thanks for joining.
Thanks for having us.
Yeah. Bye. Bye, everyone.
Bye. We'll be right back.
Daniel. Do we call you Dan or Daniel or whichever?
I prefer Dan. Daniel is when my mother is mad at me.
Okay. Cool. Well, you should get ready for a few questions, because if I'm not mistaken, that's your first time on a reread.
I'm not 100% sure, actually. I might have been on one real early, but, you know, it kind of blends together what I've just listened to and what I've been on,
yeah,
who I've talked to and who I've just listened to, and et cetera.
Do you remember getting the three questions?
Yeah, I mean, I've been on a bunch of VOKs, just not necessarily a reread.
I think you've been around, like, so much longer than I have, but just not on a reread.
Yeah, okay, so according to your WordPress page, you have not been on... Is it WordPress? Yes, it is, yeah. WordPress. According to your thingy, you haven't been on any of the rereads. You've just been on everything else.
I believe you, Sarah.
If it's wrong, it's not my fault, okay? It's... the page,
which is actually rather handy, clicking on people's names and seeing what they're in.
Yeah,
it is. It's so useful, because if I'm like, okay, wait, have I been on with this person before, which is such a bad thing to be like, or like if I'm forgetting stuff and I'm like, let me look.
Well, you,
makes it way, you know, easier.
You know everybody's voices, so it's like, you know, so I'm like listening to you talk and I'm like, oh, I know her. I heard that voice a bunch of times.
So true.
You know, I know Marie.
I know, but the question is, do they know me as a human being or just an anonymous voice on the internet? That's the hard part.
Never trust a cook, my lord. They'll prune you when you least expect it.
There's not a lot that I can easily cut out from the last 2 hours, so...
you can cut out all of my jokes.
Well, no, they're
no!
funny.
No!
The micellar water one was not funny.
I haven't heard most of them. No cutting them out.
Never trust a cook, my lord. They'll prune you when you least expect it.
Some crack pottery?
Go.
Yes, please. Yes.
All right. So, when he's in Ghost... and he sees all his brothers and sister. It was first day. Well, they first day was six, then five, and so basically, long story short, is Grey went still alive?
I think, well, it says then they were four.
Yeah,
as a head.
They were four.
Four.
Oh, come on. Talking
I have the book in front of me. I'll double check what they say.
Wait,
yeah, I think just go read the chapter again.
Yeah.
Grey Wind is part of the head chorus. Come on, it's canon.
Five whimpering blind in the snow by their dead mother, whilst he crawled off. So who died?
Lady.
No, there yeah, that's it. And there were six at the beginning. The five normal.
Cut that out.
Plus, leave it in.
Basic math, 101.
A little too cracked, pot. Never trust a cook, my lord. They'll prune you when you least expect it.
I have a theory about how John stays alive later, but that can be said later in a different chapter.
Yes, please, that'll upset me. I still hope he doesn't come back. Because that goes back to my whole... Because him coming back is the most predictable thing ever, and he's just stopped being the most predictable character ever.
Yeah.
But it happens in another book, and it happens
Sarah,
the same way in this book.
You know, like, what? In Reread 66, I was talking about that book, and no one had read it, and I was like, no one gets my
what
reference.
Book?
Well, you're talking
the
about the long seer.
The Fast.
Yeah.
Trilogy.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. Like the exact
trilogy.
Same way. And like they have the two forms of magic as well. So it's the exact same as this book. And I'm like, damn it. Bro, George, you're ripping it off. You're ripping it off.
Yeah, that's exactly the same thing. And I expect it will happen in exactly the same way.
Yes, exactly. And there's even stone dragons in that one. And there's meant to be stone dragons in this one. So,
ice dragons.
Bro. I know, which is why I'm like, we need to do a reread of that, and then we can totally intertextualize, but yeah.
Okay, I will do that with you. Actually, about the war gang, I don't remember John being as aware of the war gang before. Or is it just me?
No, I that definitely, I don't remember if I said that in my note, in my summary or not, but that really struck me too, is that he seems to sort of remember his warging and then like thinks about it after and is like, well, if I'm dreaming this, then that means that Summer and Shaggy Dog are still alive.
Even exactly.
Yeah, that's true. That was surprising.
So it was interesting that he's making a little more use of his warg ability.
Mm-hmm.
And he's trusting it too. So.
I mean, I guess he has the experience in Clash where he sees the gathering and the frost fangs and all that. So maybe that's why he trusted a little more. But
yeah,
and he's had the most exposure he's had the most exposure to other skin changes as well.
Yeah.
Well, technically, it's only skin. It's only warg if it's wolf.
That's true. Faramir six skins.
Who cares? Magic's magic.
We want to make sure this podcast is accurate. Wouldn't want to be spreading false information.
If your skin changes with a snow bear, are you a boar?
A boar.
Ha ha ha. Can we talk about how all of these characters have douchey people in them? Like, it's the prick trilogy.
Well, I mean, that's true of every chapter that we read, right? Not just today.
Most chapters, so.
It was pretty noticeable, though.
Yeah, that's right.
It was. Like, Randall Tarly, those. Stannis is being a bit difficult to deal with in this one. There's the Godfrey dude, there's Darkstar. Like, George is bringing it with these three.
Yeah.
I think that's the title of this episode, the Prick Trilogy.
Yes, please, yes.
It's in a short list. I also have a chorus of heads, but that might not be as funny.
I think that's also very good, but I think the Prick Trilogy is better.
And the reverse,
you could call it Talking
armor.
Heads.
That was
the Prick Trilogy is a little more on brand for VOK, I think.
I'm okay. I'm still thinking about the 66 title, because we had a lot of funny one, but it's probably gonna be the three-headed kitten. So
yes.
Never trust a cook, my lord. They'll prune you when you least expect it.
Noah, when are we hanging out? I haven't seen you in ages.
I know. I'm dying to play a board game soon. We need to get something going.
I'm so happy to see you guys in October.
Yes! Oh my god!
We'll be so
cool. I can't stay here because you like John, but I'm still happy to see you.
That's okay. I'll stay with Noah. He's the one who's cooking anyway.
I'll be cooking a feast.